Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish point of view. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com. Well, 2015 has been designated as the Year of Irish Design, and the largest education event taking place as part of that year took place on Thursday and Friday last at Dublin Castle. It was a conference titled Education Across the Continuum, Innovating Through Universal Design. The conference was organised by the National Centre for Excellence in Universal Design and it was supported by the Technological University for Dublin Alliance. One of the keynote speakers at the event was the co-founder of Universal Design for Learning, David Rose. David Rose co-founded CAST, which is a not-for-profit organisation with a mission to improve education for all learners through innovative uses of modern multimedia technology and current research in neuroscience. David Rose has authored several books and has been teaching at the Harvard Graduate School of Education for over three decades. When I met up with David, I noted that his talk was titled From Affect to Effect, Why Emotional Design is at the Core of Universal Design for Learning. And I asked him to explain what the talk was about.
My presentation was broadly about Universal Design for Learning, which has three principles. One about how we present information so that everybody can understand it. Two, about how we ask students to express what they know, how they act and write and speak and so on. And the third is how do we engage students in the learning process itself. And my goal was to concentrate mostly on that last piece, what do we know about the way the nervous system engages in learning, and what do we know about the individual differences that differentiate students. In reality, I talked about all three of the principles roughly equally, which was not my intent. So the emotion part has become, in both my work and the work of CAST, where I do my work, has loomed more and more important in all of our work. Engagement used to be the third thing we'd talk about of those three principles, but recent books and things, it's actually the first. And it's worth saying that in the nervous system, the location of the affective or emotional parts of the brain is right at the center of the brain. And I think it's a good metaphor for how important those are in any type of learning. The emotions drive our learning, drive our perception, drive our actions. And good educators have always known that. They know their job is largely motivating learning. And what I now talk about more is the realization that individuals are very different in what will motivate them. So the universal design principle is multiple means of engagement, that there's not a single way that is going to work for all of the students because they're really quite different. So my talk went only a little bit into that, but what is the nervous system's structures for motivation, emotion, affect, and how do they differ among students, and what can we do as teachers?
And if we take that question, what can we do as teachers to tap into the emotional side of students' learning, and particularly their motivation?
In the UDL principles, we talk about three things. One is, how do we recruit interest? All of these have sort of their basis in the way the nervous system works, but recruiting interest is that sort of first step that we often call things, words like attracting attention. How do we attract their attention among all the things that are in their world at any moment? How do we recruit their attention just to get started? The second aspect, which is harder, is how do we sustain their engagement? That we've attracted their attention, but the part that teachers really spend a lot of time and effort doing is how do we engage students in ways that are sustained, where the students are putting effort in and spending time and practicing and all of those things, which are essential parts of learning. So the second aspect is sustaining engagement. And then the third is, in the UDL guidelines, self-regulation, that we don't want to educate students who are just in a position where their attention can be attracted, or if we do extraordinary things, we can sustain their engagement. What we really want are students who can self-regulate, who can make good choices about things they want to learn, how they can handle frustration, how they can handle difficulty, how they can handle excitement. That the key thing is that students learn how to do that themselves so that they can set good goals for themselves that don't frustrate them or undervalue what they could possibly do. So those are the three aspects we look at. How do you recruit interest? How do you help sustain engagement? And thirdly, how do you help kids become self-regulatory so they're setting them rather than we are?
If you take the first two of those, David, getting the students' attention and maintaining it, it sounds as if you could learn a lot from advertising for an area like that.
It's very true. Advertisers are professional emotional designers, I call them. They are sophisticated at especially the first two of those, but actually the good ones are after all three of them. That is to say, they want to attract your attention from the big buzzing confusion of the world, and they know how to do, they have techniques. In fact, in my course this year at Harvard, I had students read a book on branding, which was just entirely a book about people who are marketers and advertisers. This book happened to be from a neuroscience-y point of view, which is how do you, as an advertiser, attract attention? And it's much the same way that teachers do. So, for example, a key way advertisers is they novelty attracts your nervous system. And most of your nervous system is all the time predicting what's going to happen. It's we're not aware of it, but at all times, you are running expectations about this is what's going to happen when I do this, or this is what's going to happen next after I see the bus, and so on. From time to time, something happens out of the ordinary, and that really attracts our attention. And good teachers are often setting up those circumstances where students are surprised by something, that their answer isn't right, for example, if they actually really cared about their answer, or something unexpected in the routine of the day, something unexpected about the way the earth goes around the sun, or whatever it is. Breaking expectancies is one of the most powerful ways to recruit interest. Let me say something about sustaining. There are things that teachers do that actually advertisers don't do so much of this, which is the long, hard, arduous, I've got to practice this and do it again and again and all that. None of us wants to do that very much. And so good teachers are looking for, how can I create the social environment that will support that? So forming groups, forming teams, joining a band. I often talk about my own learning to play the trumpet, that just when I was starting to get bored of it, my teacher put me in a band, and all of a sudden there was this huge social support and an interest in working, playing with my peers that sustained the next years of practice, whereas I would have never done that alone. So advertisers apply that same thing. They are looking to say, this is, you're part of a social network of this kind, or people like you, you know, of course, celebrities. You, inside, you're really a celebrity. You can join that group by doing these things. So advertisers get a sense of how important a social construction is to sustain effort, as just one example. The thing that I have become much more focused on lately is also what advertisers do, which is they have to go beyond recruiting your interest and even sustaining you for a while. They really want you to invest some money. There's going to be a cost. And I've become very interested in writing about good teachers are interested in their students not just being engaged, not just being interested, but investing. And so I want to explain what that means. And that means deciding that you're going to practice something now because you want to be better at it in the future. Might be playing basketball, might be crocheting or dancing or whatever. That's an investment. It's a cost to you that there's a million other things you can't do while you're doing that practicing. So just like a banker, it's an investment in your future. And what good teachers are able to do, much better, I think, than poor teachers, is not to be in charge of the kids' learning and give them extrinsic rewards for sticking at it, but finding ways in which the students themselves become investors to say, I want to practice so I can get better. And that's when I became a good trumpet player, was when it didn't matter that I was in a band, or it didn't matter that I was getting stickers on a book or anything like that, is that I was started to practice an hour to 2 hours a day because I wanted to get better. So schooling, I think, much like advertising, really needs to do things that get people investing, putting cost in. That requires different parts of your brain, prefrontal cortex, to say, I'm imagining a future. And in that future, I want to be a trumpet player. I want to be a dancer. And I'm willing to forego social media or watching TV or whatever in order to do that practice. So this third aspect of education is, I think, the one that we're going to be mostly concerned about in the future, is how do we get individual students and even schools and teachers to invest more.
One of the things that struck me when you were talking about the novelty and the importance of novelty in getting children's attention is that very often the management of a classroom thrives on routine and having things the same every day. So isn't there something quite challenging for a teacher to try and think about constantly doing things in a new way and constantly trying to make things exciting and interesting for children?
I think it's what makes great teachers great, and that is, not only is there often too much novelty, we've been doing studies of students learning in museums, and in fact, students are very engaged and excited in the museum, but when people do tests of whether they learned anything, it's often very little. So pure novelty and pure engagement are not necessarily productive in terms of kids learning things. What good teachers do is manage that novelty so that it's creating what people call desirable difficulties. That is, the novelty challenges you to think, wow, why does the sun do that? Or why did that eclipse happen? Or whatever it is that builds a desire to actually learn things is very different than just having exciting things happen. And I think that management is what good teachers do, to say, I'm going to choose how to use something unexpected, something that's a little bit surprising, to gather in my students. Now, I think under your question, though, is a very important point, which is the universal design for learning point, which is that actually students are quite different in how much novelty they prefer and how much excitement. So, for example, people on the autism spectrum find the world too exciting. There's stimulation is overstimulating that might seem just appropriate for another kid. So teachers of student, when they have a student with autism in their class, have to be rather cautious about. Can't change everything every day. It's not, they're the sort of extreme form of, you can do too much of this. So a good teacher of a child with autism would be careful to constrain the amount of novelty, to be really directed and purposeful. And most of the day would be quite predictable. That would make a child with autism feel great. In contrast, a kid with ADHD is typically bored, understimulated in classrooms. Classrooms are just not well designed for them. And making the entire day be predictable would be off-putting and result in poor learning for the kid with ADHD. And that's the challenge that good teachers are able to do, is to figure, how do I make it so that it's predictable enough so that kids who are sort of on the autism side of things feel okay and safe and ready to learn, and yet not so predictable that it's boring to students with ADHD. And that's a perpetual challenge. That's why I don't think computers solve the problem. I think good teachers are required to get a quick sense of, okay, this is too much for Billy. I need to provide Billy some quiet time. I need to give him a place to get away from all this. And similarly, okay, Sally just needs a whole lot more than I'm giving here. And I'm going to let her be on a bouncy chair or be able to go outside and do something for a while because this is too constraining. And that kind of individuation is what good teachers do all the time.
And yet you could end up teaching, well, up to 25 or 30 different lessons for all the different children in your class. How do you manage to educate all those children in the one classroom at the same time?
The field of universal design for learning came out of that challenge. And that is to say that if all the materials and activities are designed in one way, then a teacher has an extraordinary task of trying to figure out, how do I adapt this task to meet the varying constituencies in my classrooms? For the most part, that's what teachers have to do, and it's overwhelming. I was a teacher myself and remember spending a lot of my evenings not on the lesson per se, but on figuring out how to make this lesson work for the different kids I had. So Universal Design for Learning is about making sure that the materials are supportive of that, that there is, in fact, multiple ways to do things that are built in rather than that I have to make them up as a teacher. And I'm not saying that it still isn't a challenging task, but at least sort of making things all night shouldn't happen, and that teachers should expect when they get a curriculum, materials, programs, that they are already prepared for differentiation, and that there are, in the UDL sense, that there are multiple ways that kids can learn, multiple ways that kids can express themselves, and multiple ways that they can be engaged. But that should be built in from the beginning so that a teacher is live and on target with kids in the classroom rather than worrying, how am I going to make this next lesson coming up different for different kids?
You say it should be built in. To what extent have publishers and the creators of educational materials in the United States responded to incorporating the principles of universal design for learning into their materials?
There's actually been a lot of progress. Many states have adopted the UDL principles and are pushing publishers and producers of educational materials to provide them with this kind of thing. Like the state of California just had a 2-year report to set the future for how are we going to educate students in California. And they had Universal Design for Learning as a central aspect of it to address exactly the issue of, we can't expect teachers to be generating their own materials. We need to have stuff that they can use successfully. And the U.S. Department of Education just came out with a developer's kit for people who develop software, apps and things. And it too said you should do universal design for learning because, in fact, kids are different one from another. So I would say it's still in the, I guess I would say now it's in late infancy as opposed to early infancy. And lots of states have UDL now and initiatives. So it's becoming more attentive, like both of the, there's really only two big publishers left in the U.S., and both of them say they do UDL. In truth, it's like a lot of other things. It's a marketing message, and they don't do it that well. But I think they're all aware that they need to be doing something like this. So it's, I think it will get better.
Can you give an example of materials that you've seen that effectively apply or incorporate the principles of universal design for learning for any subject area?
Well, yes, I want to actually go back because there's still a tendency in myself and lots of others to think of materials as the center of the classroom. And I think the next phase of Universal Design for Learning is getting beyond that. That is, instead of thinking, how do we make textbooks that are more universally designed, which is sort of where the most of the world is now, that I think the newer initiatives have to do with, I don't know whether the maker movement has hit Ireland yet, but...
I'm not aware of it.
There's a big kind of excitement going on about kids right from the beginning, from primary school, being seen as people who make things, who invent things, and having that, it's called the maker, meaning, you know, the maker of things, rather than the receiver of things, and having kids involved in continuous experimentation rather than reading about science, but making, inventing things, taking a bunch of little things and trying to make something out of it, and not just kind of plug in, you know, Lego style, but actually creating new things. Those kinds of activities are more amenable in many ways, although still challenges, to universal design for learning, because what we find is that kids, a lot of kids who would do poorly with textbooks, do very well with various kinds of constructive activities. And what it does is it gives kids different roles. So some people are able to do one part of a challenge. You know, the challenge might be, you know, make a one that often starts as something like make a crate for an egg that you could drop it from a high building without breaking it. And you're given a bunch of materials and, you know, just make something that you think the egg would survive. But what happens even in that task is there's sort of lots of parts that end up being played with and experimented and written about and all sorts of things. And students are able to differentiate themselves to some extent. And kids, in the old way, kids get lined up mostly by who's a good reader and who's a good writer. But in the maker movement, there's sort of more opportunities for kids being able to use imagination of various kinds and be able to construct things that are surprising to a person who's a really good reader, but, oh, I would have never thought of that, and be able to draw what they want. And so more of the multiple ways in which kids can be smart come out when we expand the ways in which we assess their learning. And, by the way, these kind of things much more prepare kids for their future than there's not many jobs reading textbooks or taking multiple choice tests. But there are a lot of jobs that are going to be requiring people to be able to create new and novel solutions. So that's one aspect that I just wanted to get in before talking about materials, because I think we're getting to think materials are, A, the easy part, but also they're so dominant in the passive view of teaching and learning that, you know, in many ways, the less we do of that, the better.
The maker movement, is that being used right across the curriculum for all subject areas?
Great question. It's very, very new still. But I have to say there's a school right near me, and it's in a very, what should I say, not high-end school at all, where they've devoted a whole large area as their maker place. And kids go there because there's lots of materials and tools and things like that. But they've kind of cleaned out an area bigger than a classroom, smaller than a gym, because the maker stuff has been such a good influence on the rest of the school. It's still new, but there are whole schools that are essentially maker schools. I think your listeners, Sean, would have seen many of these things in what people call project-based learning. So makerspaces are really an outgrowth of project-based learning, which is that, and whole schools now are really formulating around that, we do projects all the time. I was at a school recently where, you know, the whole school gets into an era, like medieval period, for the whole year. And everything they do during the year, the math, the reading, the art, is all contextualized in that period, So they know deeply by making things, by having projects. How would you build a catapult that would knock down a castle or whatever? And doing the math of it and doing the diagrams of it and all of that. So project-based learning is part of this. And I would say in the U.S., there's a pushback away from the standardized, give a textbook, take an exam, to looking at how do we get learning that is much more organic, that feels like a kid's future.
And if we go back a step and say, take that more old-fashioned approach, or maybe what I might see as possibly a transitional approach from the current system we have to the maker approach, what kind of materials have you seen that do incorporate these principles of universal design for learning?
The U.S. has made progress from a policy standpoint about saying that there's a National Instructional Materials Accessibility Standard now that says essentially that printed textbooks are not sufficiently flexible to be used in a classroom without alternatives. So in the U.S. now, a school must provide alternatives to printed books if they're going to assign printed textbooks by law, which is a major change. In fact, in that law is an interesting two-word phrase that marks, I think, for me, a watershed in the way we think about kids and their education system. And that is that alternative versions, like an audio book or a digital book, a Braille book, all of those are alternate versions. They must now be provided in a timely fashion, meaning when other kids get their printed books, some kids must get these alternate versions. Those kids that must get them free of charge may have a designation, which is new, which is that they have a print disability. And that little phrase, I think, is a crack that's opening up a very different view of the landscape of education and certainly of textbooks.
And unfortunately, I have to truncate that part of my discussion with David just there. But on next week's programme, we'll hear more of what he means by the term print disability. But for this week, our time has run out. Thanks to my guest, David Rose from CAST. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by writing to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.